Welcome back to The Deep Dive. You know, usually when we talk about cutting-edge material science, we're discussing things like graphene or carbon nanotubes.
Some exotic composite.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We rarely stop to talk about steel.
Yeah.
It just feels, I don't know, solved.
Which is a really dangerous assumption to make. Steel is, I mean, it's arguably the most complex material humanity has ever mass-produced.
And we're still finding surprises.
We are still finding surprises hidden away in that atomic lattice.
That's exactly why I wanted to pull this specific research out today. We are looking at a PhD thesis from Cambridge by Jabril M.A.M. El-Fulla.
Okay.
It's titled Structural Evolution During the Plastic Deformation of Nanostructured Steel.
Hmm.
And I have to mention the supervisor here, Professor Sir H.K.D.H. Padeshia.
Oh, a giant in the field. If you've ever studied phase transformations in metals, you have definitely read Padeshia.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So the premise here isn't just, you know, let's make steel stronger. We're talking about a very, very specific material, nanostructured bainite.
Mm-hmm.
And the claim is that they are achieving strength levels of 2.5 gigapascals, which is just astronomical.
It is.
While trying to solve what seems to be its fatal flaw. Temperature resistance.
Right. And the context here is critical. Nanostructured bainite is this incredible material that's been developed over, what, the last couple of decades.
And it offers this really bizarre combination of ultra-high strength and at the same time, high toughness.
Which is the classic trade-off in metallurgy. Usually you get one or the other.
Right. If it's hard, it shatters like glass. If it's tough, it bends like a paperclip.
Exactly. But this material breaks that rule. The problem, and this is the whole focus of the thesis, is that it's a low-temperature beast.
It loves room temperature.
It does. But if you want to put it in, say, a gas turbine or high-performance engine where things get really hot, the microstructure just falls apart.
So the mission of this deep dive is to trace how El-Fulla and his team tried to redesign the alloy chemistry to keep this stuff stable at, what, 400 or 500 degrees Celsius?
Yeah, that's the goal.
But before we get to the how, we really need to clarify the what. Let's talk about the structure. When we say nanostructured bainite, we aren't talking about standard quenching.
No, not at all. And that's a crucial distinction. Most commercial high-strength steels, they rely on rapid cooling quenching to freeze a structure in place.
Mm.
This process is completely different. It's an isothermal transformation.
Meaning you hold it at one temperature.
Exactly. You heat the steel to austenitize it, but then you hold it at a relatively low temperature, say 200 to 300 degrees Celsius for a very long time.
And when you say long, the source mentions days.
Days, just sitting there baking.
Which sounds incredibly inefficient for mass production, but there must be a physical reason for it.
There is, and this is where the thesis gets into the diffusion mechanics. At 200 degrees Celsius, iron atoms, essentially, they stop moving.
They're frozen.
That's the key insight. In a standard transformation, like when austenite turns to perlite atoms diffuse, they move around, they uncouple, they find new spots.
But at these low temperatures.
At these low temperatures, the thesis calculates the diffusion distance of an iron atom to be just incredibly small.
I actually wrote this down because the number is staggering. At 125 degrees Celsius, the diffusion distance is calculated at 10 to the minus 17 meters.
Which, for anyone trying to visualize this, is it's orders of magnitude smaller than the atom itself.
So it's basically zero.
It is functionally zero. The math tells us that diffusion is physically impossible.
Okay, so if the atoms can't diffuse to rearrange themselves, how does the structure change at all? It has to transform somehow.
It shears. It's what we call a displacive transformation.
Displacive, okay.
Right. Since the atoms can't walk to their new positions, the entire crystal lattice shears collectively. It's often described as a military maneuver.
A military maneuver.
Yeah. The atoms move in this coordinated, disciplined shift, a shear on what's called the invariant plane strain.
And that shearing mechanism is what creates these incredibly fine plates.
Correct. Because the driving force for the transformation is so high and the temperature is so low, you get these really slender plates of bainitic ferrite.
About 20 to 50 nanometers thick.
Right, separated by these little films of what we call retained austenite.
And that's the magic mixture. The ferrite gives you strength, the austenite gives you toughness.
That's the dream team right there.
But going back to the thesis,
this
structure is metastable. It's frozen in a state it doesn't really want to be in.
Right. It's happy enough at room temperature. But thermodynamics is, well, it's patient. If you give it enough energy like heat, it will always try to find a lower energy state.
Which brings us to the central conflict of this whole thing. The thesis investigates what happens when you take this super steel and you heat it up.
And that retained austenite, which is the tough glue holding everything together, it starts to decompose.
It decomposes into what?
Into its equilibrium phases, ferrite and carbides. And in this context, carbides are the enemy.
Specifically cementite.
Right. Yes. Coarse cementite particles. When they precipitate out of that austenite, they act like, well, like little voids or crack initiators.
Now they make the steel brittle.
Terribly brittle. So if you have a turbine shaft made of this and it gets hot and that austenite decomposes into cementite, your toughness just evaporates.
So the goal of the thesis was to find a chemical recipe that stops that from happening, or at least slows it way, way down.
Exactly.
The researcher looked at two distinct alloys, alloy A and alloy B.
Mm-hmm.
And the results were, well, let's just say they were messy in the most interesting way possible.
Messy is a great word for it. Let's look at alloy A first. This was their silicon-heavy approach.
Okay, and the logic there is that silicon is known to slow down cementite precipitation.
Correct. Silicon has very low solubility in cementite. So if you load the steel up with silicon, and alloy A had nearly 4% by weight, which is a lot.
That's a huge amount.
It is. It surrounds the growing cementite embryos and effectively just chokes them. It creates a kinetic barrier.
It basically forces the carbon to stay in the austenite because it has nowhere else to go.
That was the plan. But the thesis found something really strange when they pushed the temperature up to around 800 degrees Celsius.
Oh.
The silicon did stop the cementite, yes. But the carbon, it eventually found another way out.
It formed graphite.
It graphitized.
Now, hold on. When I hear graphite in steel, I think of cast iron. You know, like a skillet or an engine block, which are brittle.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to make high-performance steel here. Finding graphite nodules seems like a massive failure.
So this application, it is. But scientifically, it's fascinating why it happened. Usually, to get graphite to form in steel, you need extremely long heat treatments, annealing for days.
But this happened much faster.
Much faster. Because the silicon was so effective at blocking the cementite, the carbon just, it bypassed that stage entirely.
So the thermodynamic drive was so high.
So high. And the cementite door was locked by the silicon, so it just kicked open the graphite door instead. The thesis actually compares it to Blackheart malleable cast iron.
Which is a great visual, but again, terrible for a jet engine part. You do not want little pockets of soft graphite in your high-strength beam.
No, you don't. It creates structural discontinuities. So while alloy A proved you could stop cementite, it also showed you can't just ramp up silicon indefinitely.
So alloy A is a mixed bag. They pivot to alloy B. And this is where the chemistry gets really heavy. Alloy B is loaded with nickel over 13%.
Plus cobalt and aluminum. This is a completely different philosophy.
How so?
Nickel is an austenite stabilizer. So instead of just blocking the bad stuff, the carbides, they're trying to make the good stuff, the austenite, more thermodynamically stable so it doesn't want to decompose in the first place.
And this is where the thesis highlights a really interesting failure of prediction.
Right.
They ran the simulations using MTTT data, which is a standard modeling software, and it predicted that the transformation would happen very quickly.
But when they ran the experiment,
the reaction was sluggish. It took way longer than the computer said it would.
And this is my favorite part of this whole research. It just exposes the blind spots in our models.
Because the computer just saw the overall composition.
Exactly. The computer looked at the gross composition, 13% nickel, some aluminum, and it calculated the kinetics based on that. But it didn't account for what was happening locally inside the microstructure.
What was happening?
The thesis reveals that an intermetallic compound precipitated out first, specifically nickel aluminide. Ni3L.
So before the main transformation could even get going, these little crystals of nickel aluminide formed and started, what, sucking up the ingredients?
They scavenged the matrix. They literally pulled the nickel and the aluminum out of the solid solution. So the actual steel matrix, the part that was supposed to transform, was suddenly depleted.
It didn't have 13% nickel anymore.
It had significantly less. Which fundamentally changes the chemical stability. The fuel for the reaction was effectively stolen by these little precipitates.
And that's why the computer model was wrong.
It was wrong. It assumed a homogeneous mixture, but the chemistry was changing dynamically on the fly.
That's a brilliant catch. But the result itself was actually positive, wasn't it? Despite the modeling error.
Oh, very positive. Because of this complex interaction, alloy B showed that the retained austenite could remain stable and even grow at temperatures around 400 degrees Celsius.
Which is the magic number. If you can stay stable at 400 C, You are in business for a lot of industrial applications.
Precisely. It proves that by manipulating the nickel and aluminum content, you can actually tune the stability window of the austenite.
Okay, so we've established that we can make this stuff and keep it stable with the Alloy B approach. But we need to circle back to why we care so much about this retained austenite.
We called it the glue, but it's doing something much more active, isn't it?
It is. This brings us to the Chirripi effect.
Transformation-induced clasticity.
Right.
It sounds like a buzzword, but the mechanics are crucial. We have these soft pockets of austenite trapped between the hard bainite plates. What happens when I, say, hit this steel with a hammer? Well, when you apply mechanical stress strain to the material, you're adding energy to the system. And that retained austenite, it's metastable, it's just teetering on the edge.
And the mechanical energy pushes it over.
It pushes it right over the cliff. Instantly, it transforms from austenite, which is face-centered, cubic, and soft, into martensite, which is body-centered, tetragonal, and extremely hard.
So literally at the point where the metal is being stressed and trying to fail, it transforms into a harder material to resist that failure.
Yes. It creates a local hardening effect. Imagine a crack trying to propagate through the material.
Okay.
As the stress field at the tip of that crack hits a pocket of austenite, that pocket snaps into martensite. Now, martensite involves a volume expansion. It's bigger.
So it pushes back against the crack.
It puts the region around the crack tip into compression. It literally squeezes the crack shut.
That is the self-healing aspect we teased at the start. It's not biology, it's physics, but it mimics a biological response.
Mm.
It reacts to injury by getting stronger.
And the thesis quantifies this. Elfella found a logarithmic relationship between the fraction of austenite remaining and the plastic strain. It's a predictable, tunable mechanic.
But there's a catch.
There's always a catch. It relies on connectivity.
The percolation threshold.
Right. It's not just about having some austenite. The austenite needs to form a continuous network to effectively distribute that strain.
Ah, I see.
The thesis suggests that once the volume fraction of austenite drops below a certain point, around 10%, the network breaks. It becomes isolated islands.
And then the crack can just go around them.
Exactly. Once you have isolated islands, the stress can't be transferred effectively. The crack can just bypass the tough bits and rip right through the brittle bits.
So connecting all the dots here, the reason Alloy B is so exciting isn't just that it doesn't turn into brittle carbides at 400 degrees.
No.
It's that it keeps enough austenite and keeps it stable enough to maintain that Chirripi network.
That is the grand synthesis. Thermal stability isn't just about preventing brittleness. It's about preserving the capacity for transformation.
You need the austenite to survive the heat of the engine.
So that it can still be there to transform when the engine puts it under stress. If the heat kills the austenite first, the Chirripi effect is dead on arrival.
And that's why the nickel aluminide precipitation in Alloy B matters so much.
Exactly. By stabilizing the matrix, it preserves the fuel for the Chirripi effect.
So looking at the big picture here, we have a clear move away from Alloy A, the high silicon one, because of the graphite risk, and a move toward the high nickel Alloy B.
Mm-hmm.
What's the real world scale of this? Is this just a lab curiosity, or can we actually make stuff with it?
The thesis is quite explicit that this is scalable. Remember, we aren't using exotic cooling rates. We aren't using multi-million dollar rolling mills to crush the grain structure down.
We're just using heat treatment, the slow bake.
Right. You could cast a large complex shape, like a turbine housing or heavy industrial gear, and then put it through this isothermal heat treatment. The phase transformation does the nanostructuring for you.
So you don't need to beat the metal into submission.
You let thermodynamics do the work. It sort of democratizes high-performance steel. You don't need the infrastructure of a massive steel plant to get 2.5 gigapascal strength. You just need precise temperature control.
But it does require us to accept a level of complexity in the material that we just aren't used to.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're talking about managing intermetallic precipitation, controlling austenite percentages, avoiding graphitization all in one alloy.
That is the future of metallurgy, though. We've picked all the low-hanging fruit. The old mix iron and carbon and quench it days are, they're over.
Now, we are designing alloys where the precipitations are timed to interact with the phase transformations.
Like the nickel aluminide stealing the nickel to slow down the bainite reaction. That's a dynamic system.
It is. And it suggests that our future materials will be smart in a chemical sense.
Yeah.
They'll be designed to evolve during processing and then evolve again during service, like the Chirripi effect.
Which is a perfect segue to our final thought. We started this talking about how steel feels ancient.
But this research suggests we are essentially programming the material.
We are. We're programming the lattice to respond to specific inputs, heat and stress, in very specific ways.
So if we can program steel to harden when it's stressed, and we can program it to remain stable in high heat, where does that line of thinking end?
Well, currently, the track P effect is a one-time use.
Yeah.
Once the austenite transforms to martensite, that's it. It's done.
Sure, it's spent.
The holy grail would be a reversible transformation. Imagine a material that stiffens under impact, absorbs the energy, and then, maybe with a pulse of heat or electricity, it resets itself.
So not just self-strengthening, but reusable adaptive armor.
It's theoretically possible with some shape memory alloys, but applying that to a bulk structural steel, that's the next frontier.
That's a wild concept. A bridge that braces itself when the wind blows hard and then relaxes when it stops.
Or a car chassis that's soft and comfortable for cruising, but becomes instantly rigid the moment sensors detect a collision. The material itself becomes the safety system.
It really forces us to stop thinking of materials as just these static bricks we build things with.
And start thinking of them as active participants in the mechanics of the machine.
That's the lesson. Even in material as old as iron, there is no such thing as dead matter.
It's all just atoms waiting for instructions.
And on that note, we'll wrap up. Big thanks to the work of Dr. Alfala and Professor Badeshia for giving us a glimpse into that atomic choreography. And thank you all for listening.